Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We observe today not a victory of party, but a celebration of freedom.
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
The Human Zoo, where they don't hide away the sick animals.
Dangerous mid-morning debate with the great dictator.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
Stand to attention when I'm talking to you!
On Talk Radio.
It's mess!
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. It's like Groundhog Day all over again. Someone called Johnson has resigned from the government. Someone from the Labour Party reckons Brexit can be stopped. And the leader of the Labour Party is getting grief for wearing the wrong kind of coat to the Remembrance Sunday commemorations at the Cenotaph. First things first, Katy Perry is here. We'll be discussing why a Brexit deal now seems further away than it ever was. And whether that even matters. Losing one Johnson might be considered a good idea in Downing Street, but losing two, is that irresponsible? And as for Jeremy Corbyn, I'm just going to start calling him Donald. He's taken a leaf out of Trump's book and decided to goad the media and his detractors deliberately. And guess what? It worked. If you think he put that jacket on, that anorak, whatever you want to call it, by mistake, and didn't realise there was going to be a huge hoo-ha about it, you've got another thing coming. 0344 499 1000. Coming up a little bit later on, we'll tell you why fish and chips is getting more expensive, why ironing is good for you, apparently, and what to say if your employer wants to microchip you. 0344 499 1000. You'll listen to me, Mike Graham, and Katy Perry on Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Well, it's time to say a very good morning on a Monday in November after Remembrance Sunday weekend to Katy Perry.
Good morning.
Very good
morning.
How
are we?
Wasn't it a lovely day yesterday in terms of the things that people did, in terms of the 2 minute silence, the, you know, all the various things like the faces on the beaches and all the poppies everywhere. I thought it was really, really lovely.
We did a good job as a nation.
Yeah,
I think so. I'm very proud of our kind of efforts.
Yes.
Across the board, some of the national newspapers have got wrapped around them today, saying, you know, coverage of exactly, you know, what happened yesterday, but also looking back and what happened 100 years ago. And some of the stories have been kind of really, really brought me to tears this weekend.
Oh, incredible! Yeah.
You know, about someone that died as the armistice kind of, you know, the last 30 seconds beforehand. His mother's, you know, somewhere else celebrating that the war's over and her son's coming back. Little did she know he died. Stories like that, one after another, have come, you know, I've been reading about and watching TV. And, you know, it's really, really important. I took my kids to church this weekend. I made them wear their school uniform. I made them polish their shoes.
Good.
And they were saying to me, oh, it's a bit chilly. And I said, do you think it was chilly in the trenches?
Yeah, yeah, I know.
You know, I was
turning into hyper robo mum, don't you?
I was absolutely kind of tiger mum on this stuff this weekend.
So, well, we managed to drag our kids out of their rooms and off the PlayStations for long enough to watch the 2 minute silence, which they then appreciated. We all started talking about it. And it was, I think it was just a really, really, one of those days where, as you say, you feel quite proud to be British because we're good at that kind of thing. And some great images as well over the weekend, of course. Who can forget Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin as Putin put his thumb up when he shook hands with Trump? There's that great picture of Macron and Angela Merkel sort of scowling at
looking
Putin.
Looking very suspicious.
Looking very suspicious and Trump with his huge, great grin on his face, you know. Plus, there was, of course, the business of whether he went in the rain, didn't go because of the rain, all of that. There was, of course, Jeremy Corbyn in his coat, which, as far as I'm concerned, was an absolute deliberate act. He's taking a leaf out of Donald Trump's book and he's going, I know exactly what you're going to do if I put this funny coat on. You're going to make a trivial remark about my coat and everybody's going to say, look at the media. All they do is pick on Jeremy Corbyn because of his coat.
Yeah, and the fact that, you know, if we sit here and rant about Jeremy Corbyn all morning, we're playing into his hands because he wants to be anti-establishment. He wants to be different. He wants to show his supporters that he doesn't stand there next to Blair, next to Brown, next to Cameron, and he's not like them. Well, last year he was like them because he wore a coat exactly the same as they did.
Well, somebody obviously told him not to do that.
He didn't. And so, you know what? You want to play your pathetic little games on Armistice Day, good luck to you, but I don't think you're going to get the respect of anyone.
My favourite tweet of the day from yesterday was somebody who said, basically, and it was just it wasn't anybody in the political sphere, it wasn't any pundits or anything like that. It just said, well, to be fair to Jeremy, he's normally laying a wreath in a much hotter climate than the one we had in London, so obviously he's not used to wearing a coat when he puts the wreath down. But let's talk to John Rentoul, chief political commentator for The Independent, because not only is Jeremy Corbyn wearing the wrong kind of coat, he's got the wrong kind of Brexit secretary, because Keir Starmer says Brexit actually can be stopped. John, a very good morning
to you. Hi, John.
Good morning.
I think we've covered it all there, haven't we?
That's the short version. I mean, we're now going to do the long version,
excellent,
aren't we, with all the sort of sub-paragraphs and
yes,
all that. But no, you're right. You're absolutely right. Jeremy Corbyn said he was asked by Der Spiegel, yeah, I mean, because he doesn't get a fair hearing from the British mainstream media, so he has to go and be interviewed by German journalists who then ask him sarky questions about didn't Tony Blair win three elections. But no, he told that one of the sarky questions they asked him was, would you stop Brexit if you could? And he said, we can't stop Brexit.
Yes.
And then up pops Keir Starmer this morning to say, well, Brexit can be stopped.
Yes.
But he didn't sound very enthusiastic about it. To be fair to Keir Starmer.
So you don't see his kind of intervention as a kind of a possible tanks in the lawn type scenario.
Well, yeah, no, it certainly was. I think it was. He was trying to contradict. Well, he was trying to correct his leader without appearing to contradict him, if you see what I mean. But I mean, you can't do that. I mean, one said one thing and one said the opposite. But I mean, Keir Starmer is right that he was spelling out Labour Party policy.
Right.
And what Jeremy Corbyn said was not quite contrary to Labour Party policy because. The policy is that all options are on the table. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn forgot to mention that, but I mean, Jeremy Corbyn sounded like he didn't want to stop Brexit. That was the problem.
Well, everything you've read and everything you know, especially from this latest weekend's papers, John, do you think we're edging closer to a no-deal Brexit?
Yes, I do, but I mean, I've got no idea what's going on in this tunnel. Which is a fancy way of saying they're having private negotiations in Brussels. I'm completely torn. I've got no idea what's going to happen, I have to admit. It's probably safest. That's the safest thing, because if I make a prediction, it'll probably be wrong, and then, you know, you'll have me on and laugh.
But, I mean, this is in its own way terribly refreshing, John, because, of course, everybody who also doesn't know what's going to happen keeps pretending that they do know what's going to happen and telling us.
Well, indeed. So I'm not going to do that.
Good.
I mean, a lot of my sources say that it's, you know, it could easily be a no-deal Brexit by accident because the two sides sort of keep sort of misunderstanding each other. And, you know, we're getting very close to the deadline now.
Right.
But if I stand back and look at it, I think, well, you know, it's so much in the interests of both sides that there is a deal, that surely there's some kind of fudge and sort of form of words. But, I mean, that can get us over the line. But, I mean, what's extraordinary is the EU seems to be hardening its line at this point, and right, it looks as if they don't want to deal. But, I mean, the problem with that is they have promised the Irish, total solidarity, and they've promised the Irish that there will be no hard border in Ireland. Now, the only way of delivering on that promise is to do a deal.
Mm.
Because if there is no deal, then there will be a hard border. So I don't know who's going to blink first, and I don't know what.
And isn't that what it's all about? It's all about the blinking. I mean, there are those who believe that the no deal is now closer than it's ever been, because, as you say, there are so many different forms of deals that they'll never actually agree on one. And that seems to be the difficulty here, doesn't it? Because on both sides, both over in the EU and here in the government, you can't really find two people that agree on what the deal should be.
No, but I mean, but except that the deal could be, you know, let's just agree to a form of words on this on the Irish border.
Mm.
You know, that we'll try and make it work, and then we can negotiate after we've left. Now, why? But they can't get there because the EU keeps imposing new conditions. Like that, now, suddenly they want our fish, and you know they're saying we've got to agree to this Irish backstop guarantee in perpetuity, and it's got to be arbitrated by the European Court of Justice. They must know that this is, you know, these are things that are going to be very, very difficult, if not impossible, for Theresa May to accept, and yet they seem to be determined to mess it up at the last minute.
The situation that Theresa May's now in, though, is that she can't get consensus from any part of her party large enough to get something through. So you talk about pressures from European courts of justice, but also pressures such as fishing rights and things like that. But what
yeah.
we've seen over the weekend since Joe Johnson's resignation is the Remainers saying that they're not happy with this deal either. So we thought up until now it'd be the Brexiteers that say, no, we don't agree to this, we won't sign up to it. But yet there are many Remainers in her cabinet and across government who are saying, we don't like this either. This is the worst of all deals. And so where does that leave her in the end?
Well, in a very tricky position. But actually, I mean, the thing about Joe Johnson is he's not just a Remainer. I mean, he's a hard Remainer. He actually wants to reverse Brexit. But there are other people like that in the Tory party. But they are a minority in the Tory party, as are the hard Brexit, you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg, let's just sort of throw up the whole thing and just leave without a deal. Mm. I mean, those are in a minority too. So, I mean, there is a majority there for a deal, but the EU's got to make it possible. And, you know, maybe they never intended to. But in which case, we've been led up the garden path for the past 2 years.
Yeah, indeed. And part of the problem now as well is that we're all beginning to realise that actually anything is now possible, really, because every promise that has been made has pretty much been broken. Every deadline that has been set has been pretty much broken as well. And so in the end, are we actually really going to get to March 29th? I mean, we could presumably get there and then nothing happens.
Well, something's going to happen on March 29th. I mean, if we leave the EU... Then if we haven't,
yeah,
got
what
a
if
deal,
we don't though? What if we just get an extension? What if it just kind of drags on, well, kind of, you know, limitlessly?
Well, that's one of the options for which there is not really. Well, I don't know if there's a majority for that in the House of Commons. That is a big question.
Yeah.
If there's no deal, and the choice is no deal or extend Article 50,
yeah,
what would the House of Commons vote for? And I've genuinely, again, don't know the answer to that question. Yeah. Because I think it's rather difficult. I suspect that there would be a majority to leave without a deal.
Right.
I mean, whatever, the consequences of that would be disruptive in the short term, certainly.
There certainly would be no appetite, presumably, in the House of Commons for a second referendum, would there?
Well, there is some appetite, but...
No, again, I know there is some, but not enough.
But not enough. No, you're right. That is another option.
John, can you see the Labour Party adopting that as an official position coming
no.
the new year?
No, because Jeremy Corbyn won't countenance it. Jeremy Corbyn does not agree with having a second referendum because he does not agree with staying in the EU. I mean, the only people who support a second referendum, and my newspaper does actually, The Independent, supports a second referendum, but the only people who do support a second referendum are those who want to see the result of the original referendum reversed.
Right.
I mean, there aren't that many people. Sorry, there are one or two of my colleagues. There aren't many people who voted leave and now say, oh yes, we should have a second referendum.
And what price does Theresa May pay for all of this if she does get a Brexit deal through? Do you think that she can see herself all the way through to the next general election, or they'll say, look, this has been an absolute mess.
Yeah.
It's been a complete fudge. We ended up with something we didn't want, and the price you pay is that you have to go.
Well, I think that would have to happen anyway. But if she gets a deal, then I think she postpones the date of her departure by some time.
Mm.
I mean, possibly several years. I mean, you know, if she gets a Brexit deal, then she ought to be carried shoulder high through the streets. I mean, that would be an astonishing achievement. I mean, especially after all the negativism we've
but nobody's going to be happy no matter what happens. It's the tragedy of all of this.
Well, exactly. I mean, they ought to be. They
yeah.
ought to be praising her to the skies. But actually, the hard Brexiteers will be furious because it won't be what they want, and the Remainers
right.
will be furious because we've still left. So, yeah, she'll still be in a difficult position. But, I mean, if she doesn't get a deal, then that would be a historic failure. And that really should be the end of her time as Prime Minister, except that... You know, you still got. She's not going to. They can't get rid of her unless a majority of Tory MPs want to get rid of her, and they're not going to do that unless they've got an alternative.
And some of them are afraid of the replacement, aren't they, John?
Well, exactly. I mean, they don't want to see Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, which is, you know, a risk you take because the final choice is made by the party members in the country. So, you know, however useless they think she is. Even if she fails to get a deal, which would be a historic failure, you know, she may survive for some time to come.
Now, I know you don't want to make any predictions, but how about this for a possible prediction? Will there ever be a time when this country returns to normal, where we can actually walk about without talking about Europe and Brexit and whether you're a Remainer or a Ramona or, you know, a Brexiteer or whatever the hell it is? I mean, it's become ridiculous.
It has, and the short answer to that is not for many years, because...
Dear God.
Because even if there's a deal, or if there isn't a deal, then, you know, there are going to be questions of our relations with Europe and our trade with Europe, which are going to have to be negotiated and decided over the next 3, 4, 5 years. I mean, perhaps the intensity will abate if we actually leave on the 29th of March, because, you know, then we'll be in a slightly different position. But
I think it's going to be the other way around, John. I think we're only just starting and it's going to be terrible. This time next year, we're going to be fighting over every little kind of amendment to a bill, every little fishing right, one tiny piece of water versus another. Mm. It's going to be a nightmare.
Well, price of fish and chips is already going up. We're going to be talking about that later on. I'm also reliably informed, John, you may know this, that the Brexit withdrawal agreement is now at least 500 pages long.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, it needs to be fairly... Yeah, it's a fairly substantial international treaty, isn't it?
So,
yeah,
paid enough for it.
It's got a lot of stuff in it, because it's got to have the Irish backstop in it, and it's got to have all that stuff about the divorce bill and citizens' rights. I mean, that is... Yeah, there's a substantial document there. And you know, ministers have actually been in to see, to read the 95% of it, which is finished. Mm. But it's the 5% that hasn't been finished that is the difficult bit.
No, indeed. And I read with interest over the weekend that your old mate David Miliband might be returning to these shores, because he's had enough of being doing good over in the United States of America. So he wants to come back and maybe form himself into a new political movement. What do you reckon?
No, not going to happen. I mean, I think David Miliband was a wonderful leader, and he should have been leader of the Labour Party in 2010. He should even have been leader of the Labour Party in 2009 and fought the 2010 general election instead of Gordon Brown. But he was never sort of demented and ruthless enough to oust Gordon Brown. And, you know, in the end, he couldn't even beat his younger brother. So I think that was the end of his political
It's all Ed Miliband's fault, I tell you. I think
we could certainly lay quite a lot of the blame at his door. What about my analogy with old Donald Corbyn? I'm calling him Donald from now on, because he's now clearly operating as a Trumper and just upsetting the media just for the hell of it.
What, you mean by wearing a coat?
Yeah. What's his next trick going to be?
I'm not bothered about what he was wearing. I mean, I didn't think it looked very smart. But, I mean, actually, the thing is, he normally does that gig in a dark suit.
Yes, which is what he did last year.
Yes, but this time he thought it might rain, so he had to put a coat on, and that's the only
coat. Well, there's the other similarity with Trump.
Yes. But
scared of the rain.
He did actually turn up to do it, and he did actually put the wreath down.
Well, to be fair to Trump, Trump also turned up. He just didn't turn up in the place he was meant to turn up.
No, that's right. He didn't go out to the American cemetery.
Yeah.
But Jeremy Corbyn was prepared to go out in the rain. Actually, it didn't rain as it happened, but he did put his...
Can you imagine him with the hood up? That would have been even worse.
Well, that...
To be honest, I was a bit more worried about the guy from the SNP with the kilt on when he leaned over to put the wreath down. I had all sorts of horrible images in my head. I thought that was a very unwise choice of dress.
Well, I've got some latest news breaking. Michael Gove, doorstep by Sky News this morning, says, I haven't seen those comments when he's asked about Boris Johnson's cabinet should mutiny comments in the Telegraph. Yeah, right.
Hasn't seen them.
Yeah, right.
He's had a busy morning then, hasn't he, I guess?
Yeah. But Boris Johnson's article in the Telegraph this morning is exactly the same as the one he wrote, you know, last week and the week before
I've given up reading the articles.
Michael Gove has seen it.
To be honest, I've given up reading Boris Johnson now, because apart from the fact that he now not only writes in the Telegraph, he also writes in the Sun and all other newspapers that he can get his hands on. You know, it's all very boring, to be honest.
I did read it just to check that he didn't have an alternative to Theresa May's policy, and lo and behold,
he doesn't.
No. I mean, it's quite a good rant for most of the article, and then sort of about three quarters of the way through, he thinks, oh, hang on, I better just say what my alternative is, because otherwise people will go on about it.
It's £275,000 a year, John.
Well, exactly. But his alternative consists of one paragraph saying, you know, let's do a Super Canada Plus, and the Irish and the EU will agree to it. Mm. No, they won't.
No, I know.
It's simple as that.
I fear, John, we will be having many more of these conversations, and we may not actually be discussing anything different from the last time we spoke, and the next time we speak will no doubt be the same. But thank you very much indeed, John Rental, at least an honest political pundit, saying that he doesn't know what's going to happen, because nobody knows what's going to happen. Why are there so many people out there who keep telling us that they're absolutely certain that if this happens, then that will happen? You know, if you do that, then this will be the disaster. Nobody knows the answer, which actually makes it a bit more interesting, doesn't it? 03444991000. Let's talk to Alan, who's in Birmingham. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Alan.
Yeah, hi there.
Yeah, what do you want to say, Alan?
I'm calling in about Mr. Corbyn.
Oh, yeah.
I'm an ex-serviceman. I've served in the army. I've attended the Cenotaph for the last 3 years. I didn't attend this year.
Okay.
I went local this year because I thought it was important to do that. But let's look at Corbyn over the last 3 years. Firstly, it's only in the last 3 years that he's actually been wearing a poppy. Prior to that, he's never worn one in his life.
Okay.
It's only in the last 3 years that he's actually learned how to dress properly. Mm. You've only got to look at the way he dressed before the spin doctors got hold of him and tidied him up a bit.
Right.
The contempt that he has shown for the armed forces and the disrespect that he's shown for the armed forces and veterans historically is on record and very well known. He is a past supporter, publicly and privately, of the Irish Republican Army.
Yeah.
He claims now that he was involved in the peace process. He had nothing to do with it. He was a low-level backbench MP who was a bit of a joke at the time. So the only claim to fame he had was bringing Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness over to London. And actually, he held a two-minute silence in the House of Parliament to the three terrorists that were shot in Gibraltar.
Mm.
So wearing the coat that he wore yesterday, I think, to be honest, compared to a lot of the past things he's done, it's quite minor. But yeah, I mean, maybe his spin doctors weren't around on a Sunday morning to tell him how to dress.
No, I think everything he now does, Alan, and you're absolutely right to point out all those things that you've just done. But I think everything he now does is done with quite a lot of thought, with a fair amount of expectation of how it will be received, because it plays into his audience, which is what Donald Trump does very well. It plays to his audience. So all of the people that like Corbyn are all up in arms because of people like you and I who are saying it's a bit disrespectful to wear that kind of coat to the cenotaph.
Well, he avoids veterans on every occasion he can. I'm involved in a veterans group called Justice for Northern Ireland Veterans, and basically what we're about is the witch hunt that's going on at the moment for veterans when all these terrorists have been elected.
Which is a disgrace, by the way. We've talked about
that
on the
show. Yeah, and I'm actually the founder member of the group. And, I can give you two occasions where he's avoided us.
Hmm.
The first occasion was a year ago. In fact, it was a year ago, early December, when we went to Barnstable because he was having a Labour rally down there. And we stood outside because we wanted to confront him about his IRA support.
Right.
And he went in the back door. The other time was more recent, and that was back in June. And we were outside Parliament, and he saw us, and he literally ran away. He literally ran away from us. And there were only three or four of us standing there. And we went to approach him, and he ran. He physically ran away from us. So, Corbyn, I actually personally think it's an insult to have him there on Armistice Day. I think if the Labour Party had anything about them, they would ask him to respectfully stay away and maybe put someone in like Keir Starmer or someone else who actually doesn't have to be forced to wear a poppy. I think Corbyn, God forbid that man ever got into power in this country, it would be an absolute national disaster.
Yeah.
And would make this Brexit fiasco pale into insignificance.
Well, exactly. And because, one thing you haven't mentioned is associations with some of the more ghastly members of the Middle Eastern conflict, right?
Well,
and the idea that, as somebody said yesterday, you know, you're normally used to laying wreaths in places where the temperature is a lot warmer. Whole debacle over the Hamas, this Black September thing, you know, everything he's done, he hasn't ever been able to justify. And he tries to make up a story about how he was, involved in the peacemaking process. Absolute nonsense. He cannot bring himself to even say the word Israel, never mind anti-Semitic.
And he's repeatedly, sorry to cut across you there, it sounds like we're singing off the same hymn sheet anyway, but he has repeatedly refused to condemn the IRA.
Yeah.
And he still won't do it. He has repeatedly refused to condemn the IRA. But he does have his deluded followers. And, you know, if we take this year as an example, Armed Forces Day, where did Jeremy Corbyn go? He went to the Glastonbury Festival.
Yeah, right.
Because it's young people who are not aware of his ghastly past.
Yeah, right. That is the problem. Well, there are people who also believe, Alan, that this is the man who will lead us out of this ghastly kind of, you know, establishment-led world in which we live. He's been part of the establishment for 35 years. He's never done anything but work in the House of Commons. If that's not part of the establishment, I don't know what is.
No, exactly. I mean, he's, honestly, he just, the man, I can't even look at him. I can't listen to him. Anything to do with him, basically, I just find totally and utterly abhorrent.
And do most of your colleagues from the armed services feel the same way?
Yeah, well, he did. He went on that little walk. Remember his first year when he was attended? I like I said, I wasn't there this year, but when we line up, we normally line up on Whitehall
right. In
the columns before we march down, and there's a big screen in front of us. And whenever he comes out, there is a silence. We don't boo because we don't want to disrespect, you know, the occasion that it is.
Sure.
But yeah, he went for a walk around the first year, and I think he got the message that he is despised within the veteran community, totally and utterly despised. And I have friends who are Labour supporters and lifelong Labour supporters who will not vote Labour because he is the leader of the Labour Party. And, you know, just everything about him is vile. He's just a despicable... He's a national disgrace.
If Jeremy Corbyn doesn't think it or say it, we will. We'd like to thank you for your service, Alan, because I hope we did you proud, you and your colleagues proud this weekend, because it wasn't just about the 100 years ago. It was about every conflict since then. So I hope you feel that the rest of the nation did you proud.
Well, it was an honour to... it was all about the First World War this weekend, and rightly so, because no matter what I went through or anyone else went through, no one can imagine what those men went through in the First World War. It was a war to end all wars, yeah. But suddenly didn't.
Indeed.
But the slaughter, the mass scale of slaughter. Someone said that if you were to join the two lines of veterans from the First and Second World War together in a column of four, they would go from London to Newcastle. That's how many men lost their lives. Mm. So, you know, yeah, I served in Northern Ireland. We lost over 700 soldiers there. So for a Northern Ireland veteran to look at that creep, you know, when we know what he supported and actually held silences for terrorists. Mm. And that's what they were. They weren't freedom fighters.
No.
They were terrorists. And we still don't in this country have a national memorial to the dead of the Northern Ireland conflict. We always refer to it as the Troubles, but it was a war. It wasn't. It wasn't Troubles.
No,
it was
exactly.
A war. You know, but yeah, Corbyn is, you know, the man just, honestly, he just makes my blood boil.
We can tell. Alan, listen, great call. Thank you very much indeed. Alan in Birmingham there telling it like it is from the point of view of many veterans, in fact, probably all veterans, who have served for Her Majesty's Armed Forces.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now, talking of Millionaire's Row, have you seen this story today from Britain's youngest Euro Millions winner, Jane Park, right? She's 23. She won the Euro Millions when she was 17 years of age.
How much did she win?
She only won £1 million.
Only.
Okay. But apparently it's ruined her life.
Of course it has.
She hasn't been able to keep a bloke. Every boyfriend she's had, she's worried that they only want her for her money. Right? Guess what she's doing now?
Go on.
She's now offering and the next boyfriend that comes along to be paid £60,000 a year to basically be her boyfriend. She said, I've had enough of people coming and expecting me to pay for everything, so I'm now going to actually give them a salary to be my boyfriend.
Is that what you were doing the other break, filling in your application form?
Please. No, it's not enough. I mean, I can't give up working for 60 grand, can I?
That's
not enough. Plus,
yeah, right.
You know, I'm not in the market for a 23-year-old lottery winner,
no,
to be honest.
No, of course you're not.
And also, she lives in Scotland.
I'm not in the market for a 23-year-old lottery winner.
I'm not. Why would you say that?
No, it's just that, you know, she's someone, I won't say whom, but someone Googled
her
earlier.
She's not my type, to be honest.
And thought, oh, she'd be, you know, pretty, you know, she's very attractive.
But you know what she wants you to do with the money? She wants you to spend it on her.
Naturally.
What's that all about?
What's wrong with that?
Well, why would she give you money to then tell you what to do with it?
Because we are women.
If I give
we
money,
are women in life.
Well,
that's
yeah.
What you should
but
be
say,
expect.
For example, the roles were reversed.
Yeah.
Can you imagine the outrage and outcry there would be if some guy won the lottery and offered 60,000 quid a year to a woman to be his girlfriend? Can you imagine what
I think
they'd
there'd
say?
Be a massive outcry.
And they'd say you're encouraging
say
prostitution.
And there'll be a queue as long as your arm.
Really?
Yeah.
You think?
There'd be loads and loads of applicants.
Yeah.
Now, she seems to be... She actually needs some help, I think, because she probably thinks that she's not all that in terms of her worth. Because
well, she has had a few things done to herself.
To find a man.
She's had
and
a few things
beautiful,
done.
She's lovely. And, you know, I think that she possibly needs to spend the money on other things. I don't think.
Well, why don't you get on the phone to her, right? Tell her, look, this is not a good idea.
Yeah, I think I should give her a ring and
friendly,
say, look, love.
Sisterly advice.
Yeah, if you were my friend, I'd say, you're just fine as you are. You're fine, a great guy. And you know what? This is why you shouldn't make public you won, you see?
Right.
Because if you're going to check up with someone, you can then let them in, you know, after the wedding day and say, by the way, just to let you know, I've got a few pounds more than you anticipated.
Yes.
You don't publicise the fact that you're a winner. Of course they're all going to be.
I can see the logic in actually giving somebody a fixed amount of money rather than just them coming to you going, you know, can I borrow 10 grand or something, or can I have a car, or I don't know. See,
yeah,
I wouldn't
do any of those things.
Well, I wouldn't either. It's hard for me to fathom what that would be like.
But if you're living together eventually yeah. with your partner, then, right. you know, you will access joint accounts together or you will share money. And so it's not ridiculous to say that, you know, as
yeah,
part
but you don't
of
want
our
somebody's
life.
Paying you a salary.
But you don't advertise it as, a, you know, the first knockings, you know, kind of. You could just imagine on some Tinder and things, people swipe
yeah,
and
yeah.
go, swipe, comes with £1 million.
Yeah.
Done.
Really?
You know, and she wonders why she can't, you know, secure a guy that's actually...
And she's only 23. I mean, she's not going to have that much money forever, is she?
No.
£1 million doesn't go as far as it used to.
I'd be saving the 60 grand because you're going to need that when you're 40, love.
Yeah, exactly.
Believe me.
And also, what about, you know, by the time you, you know, need the old care home, you won't have any money left.
No,
so
it's game over.
You've given it all away to some bloke.
This is going to end in tears.
It's
I'm telling
good.
You now. This
I'm not
going to
tell you
tears.
What she wrote on her Instagram post either, because it's not the right time of day.
Is it rude?
It's quite... Well, it's not that rude, but it's not really suitable for the radio, I would say.
See, I think she's hanging around with the wrong people,
yeah.
the wrong crowd, and doing the wrong things.
Yes.
I need to be motherly. I'm feeling very maternal with this young lady. Yes.
Okay.
Maybe she needs to go back to, you know, university or something. And
I don't
you know,
think she
go...
ever went there.
No?
I don't think she'd be
you
going back.
You don't think so?
Well, she used to work in an £8 an hour job as an admin temp.
Okay.
So I don't think she went to university, which doesn't make her a bad
person.
No,
but I just feel that she you know, she needs to take her time.
Maybe she's travel.
Yes, that would
travel
be a good
the
idea.
World, right? And then nobody would know her. So they wouldn't know that she had £1 million.
Yep, and she could turn up in another country.
She could turn up in somewhere like Milan.
And, you know, meet some right? hunky guy.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter that he doesn't know that she's a millionaire.
Exactly. And then she doesn't have to tell anyone that she's got
no.
all that money. And that, maybe that's the secret.
They've never discovered the internet, no?
Well, maybe go somewhere where they haven't got the internet. You know,
should we go to Bora Bora?
Fiji. Somewhere like that. This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, 03444991000. Collegy, who sent us some great tweets on the car front, has finally lost the plot. He says, I guess the ultimate deterrent for cars being stolen to order is make every car look the same, act the same. Boring, I know, but I always fancied a Lada. Trust me,
oh
mate.
Oh, my God,
you don't
that's Jeremy Corbyn's government.
Yeah, yeah.
In
everybody
a
gets a Lada. I've driven Ladas. They're not worth driving. So, I had a, you know, when I was in Bosnia, right? BBC were there, The Telegraph, they all had these bulletproof Land Rovers, right, which weigh so much because you literally can't pierce them with a bullet.
Yep.
I was in a Lada, right, which was known
Did you
as...
you have a sign on you saying, shoot
as,
me?
It was known as a soft car.
Soft car.
Yeah, and I once went, when you're in these places, right, you get a sort of false sense of security.
Yep.
And I ran out of, you had to always carry a big can of spare petrol with you, but that started to run down, so I was told you better go to the nearest petrol station outside of Vitez, right? But the problem is there's a sniper between the army camp and the petrol station. When you get to the petrol station, there's a load of sandbags, so he can't shoot you while you're filling up your car because he's in the hills over there. And this guy said, but don't worry, if you do a steady 90 clicks, 90 miles an hour, 90 kilometres an hour, he can't hit you, you know? So as long as you
in your Lada.
Literally pedal to the metal in the Lada. So I went, yeah, I can do this, you know, look at me. I'm a boy, I can do this. So I absolutely went like hell for leather, 90 kilometres all the way down, filled up the car, drove back 90 kilometres all the way back. And I thought, I've just done the most exciting thing in my life I've ever done. Nobody shot me. I've managed to avoid the sniper. It's fantastic. That night, I was having a drink with the guys in the army. And I said, and I told them the story. And they said, that's rubbish, by the way. Yeah, he can hit you no matter what speed you're doing. I'm like,
my gosh.
Oh, God, really?
You wouldn't have gone if you'd known that.
No. I wouldn't.
Oh, my gosh.
Anyway, let's talk about fish and chips. Leslie Graves is a member of the board of directors of the National Federation of Fish Fryers and owner of the award-winning Burton Road Chippy in Lincoln.
Oh,
Leslie,
I'm hungry.
We're desperate for fish and chips now, Leslie. How are you?
Good morning, Leslie.
I'm good, thank you. Good morning.
Now, listen, we're hearing that Britons are turning away from the old staple of fish and chips because they're getting too expensive.
Rubbish.
All right, OK. Fair enough. How much is it for a basic haddock and chips in your gaff?
In my gaff, it's about £5.
That's cheap, you see. That's really cheap.
Exactly. It still represents good value for money.
It's not like that around the rest of the country,
Not only good value for money, it's also one of the healthiest takeaways options. You know, we've got natural nutritional ingredients, and not many takeaways can actually lay claim to that. And I think historically it's really been undersold and undervalued.
Yes, no, I absolutely agree with you, because we've also got the worry coming up that we won't be able to get as much haddock and cod out of the sea as we used to in years to come.
There certainly is price increases on fish and potatoes, and obviously we're all conscious environmentally of looking at the sustainability of fish. I think it's important that we try different species as well. But I think there's a lot of scaremongering going on.
Oh, yeah.
But I think portion sizes is key, really. If we look at the portion sizes that historically we've sold, that it's potentially too much. We often find that people are sharing one portion, which really lays claim to the fact that it's the size
that it's
is too
big. Yeah, well, I've been to many fish and chip shops where they'll do, you know, say a large fish and chips, and sometimes they'll give you two fish if it's a large one, you know. And you don't really need two fish, do you?
No, you don't. You don't. I mean, we're in a world where we're looking, like I said, at the environment. We're also looking in a world where we don't want waste.
Yeah.
And I think potentially there's a lot of waste involved in takeaways because our eyes are often bigger than our bellies.
Yes.
If you were to go home and put your takeaway that you've got wrapped up from your takeaway, you put that on a plate, there's no way you would have put your plate that large.
No. Exactly right. In my case, unfortunately, my belly is actually genuinely bigger than my eyes, but that's my own fault.
Well, you know.
That's my own fault. But tell us, what's your sort of alternative to haddock and cod then? Skate? I mean, what else can you deep fry?
Well, anything on the sustainable list. There's lots of whitefish out there. There are lots of blackfish that we often underutilise. I mean, the key being that it's from Marine Stewardship Council's sustainable sources.
Right, OK.
Pollock, maybe?
And yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think going back to, say, 1976, for example, when there was a drought, we had a drought and the potatoes, we had problems with potatoes. There was a lot of fish and chip shops closed because potatoes were so expensive. And when they reopened, they were giving larger portions to bring back the customers that they felt that they'd lost.
Yes.
And I think generally we're not multinational companies. We're all independent people. And fish and chip owners are genuine feeders of people, if you like, whether that's within their community.
I mean, the local fish and chip shop has always been traditionally the kind of, you know, the staple of the high street. But we've been hearing all this year, really, that the high street is changing, isn't it, a lot?
Of course it is. Of course it is. And the prices and the competition that we're facing has led to smaller shops perhaps trying to combat that by giving larger portions and therefore suffering from the profitability on that, and now adding in the price increases that we are facing from fish and potatoes and shortages or whatever, that they're then going to struggle.
The thing is,
though, I'm sure we will see some shops close.
You have talked about the fact that, you know, where you are, your gaff, as Mike likes to put it, it's a fiver, which is fantastic value for money. But where I live, and, you know, we're on the outskirts of London, into Kent, but we're not as far as the coast. You know, fish and chips could easily set you back £8, easily, £8 or £9. Mm. And we've in central London, because it's a tourist trap, Mike was telling me he's seen adverts for £15.95.
There are pubs. No, there are pubs in London selling fish and chips and putting it out there as if it's a good deal. £15.99. You know.
Yeah, which I would have to say is probably not as good a quality as in your local chippy.
No.
I mean, certainly pub chains are getting better at what they do, and I'm no disrespect to them. But it's not the same product as from the local fish and chip shop. And like I say, we've totally undervalued what it is we do and the ingredients that we're using. I mean, it's fresh, natural ingredients. What other takeaway can say that?
Where do you get your fish from, Leslie? Do you get it from a sort of a local supplier or what?
Well, yeah, it predominantly comes from Norway, comes into Grimsby, and that's about 40 miles away from us, but also Scotland as well, Scottish haddock and cod, which is all MSC certified. You know, we're not struggling as yet with the supply of that, but I know quotas are being cut and things are tightening and prices are going up and they're set to increase.
Yeah. And have you found... sorry, Lizzie, go on.
I was going to say, I think what we need to do as our businesses is to offer various portion sizes at cost to suit the public.
Sure. And do you find you've had to offer different things as well around the fish and chips? You know, like, I don't know, pickled eggs and you know, sausages and pies and all that?
Traditionally, shops do that anyway.
Right.
And I think people are becoming more resourceful by making homemade fish cakes, for example,
yes,
with the fish that they're getting, which makes that go further, which still represents, again, good value for money.
Sure. You've got a fan on Twitter. I've got somebody called Matt who's tweeted me saying, if you ever get a chance to go to the Burton Road Chippy, it's absolutely fantastic. So I'm going to have to come and pay you a visit.
I mean, ultimately, fish and chips are in our DNA. They're our national dish. If the price of cheese, for example, went up in Italy, they're not going to stop pizzas, are they?
No.
You know, why? We're going to find ways to deal with this. And to me, it's, you know, I think people, the general public, are not actually stupid. They can see that their shopping bills are going up. They can see the prices in supermarkets. So they ultimately expect us to react to that in our businesses, and our prices will have to go up.
They do, but they would possibly not have fish and chips as much as they are used to having it, because it becomes more of a luxury than an everyday thing. For example, if it's £8 each, you know, family four for having a quick takeaway is £32. That's not cheap.
No.
It's not cheap, but is it value for money?
Well, that's one of the good arguments you've raised today, because possibly we've been undervaluing it for a number of years.
Totally.
And we've just been used to it being a certain lower price. And you know, we're surprised and shocked when it goes up. And actually, maybe it is worth that.
Mm. Do you do breaded stuff as well, Leslie, as well as the deep?
Yeah, we do. We do poached. We do pan fried.
Mm.
We cater. I think that's another thing that shops can do is cater to different dietary requirements, because obviously that's something that's in the forefront of everybody's mind these days.
Sure.
There's a lot more people that have allergies and things like that as well. So I think catering for varied dietary requirements is a must as well.
Sure. Brilliant. Well, listen, good luck with it, Leslie. It doesn't sound like you need any luck. It sounds like you're doing a fantastic
job. It's a proper
fish and chip shop. Yeah. I'm not surprised.
We'll expect to see you soon.
Yes, well, any time I'm up near Lincoln, I shall come and pay you a visit. Brilliant. Leslie, thank you very much indeed. Leslie Graves.
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday on Talk Radio, via DAB, online or via the Talk Radio app. If you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.